without further ado, I will start presenting our speakers tonight. First off, we will start with Mr. Dave Bleakney. He is the National Education Director of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers in Ottawa, a labor union that, as I said before, took a stance in support of BDS, of the BDS movement in 2008. And also, Dave has been a longtime global justice activist and has recently participated in the Gaza Freedom March in December 2009. We also have Kit Raphael from San Francisco, who made feminist and queer liberation and anti-militarist activism and organizing the organizing center of her life for 30 years. She's based in Oakland, California. She works with QUIT, Queers Undermining Israeli Terrorism, and Lagiat Queer Insurrection. The Gay Queer Insurrection, which may be the oldest radical queer collective in the world. She worked in Palestine from 2002 to 2005 as a member of the International Women's Peace Service and was deported by Israel in early 2005 after spending a month in prison. Also, we have Shadi Rowana. He is a Palestinian from Haifa, who is the coordinator of the Alternative Information Center in Palestine, is the Jerusalem coordinator at the AIIC and Spanish-speaking website. Shadi interned in the Chiapas Peace House Project in Chiapas, Mexico. His work there helped with understanding how indigenous communities become invisible in dominant cultures. And he's also working on the preservation of the history of Haifa pre the Nakba 1948. So without further ado, I present to you Dave.
This is good. Can you hear me? You can hear me? Good. It's a real honor to be here tonight, and I'm very encouraged. The honor is the fact that there's so many people struggling in Palestine and have refused to surrender their collective dignity for a future in the worst of circumstances. And it's also, I'm very encouraged by the turnout here and the growing turnout and the growth of the BDS movement in general. Noam Chomsky refers to it as a harsh and brutal occupation where life is made unlivable. And I'm not going to give you a list of facts because I think a lot of us here know them. Just a quick review of, we know about atrocities, we know about the civilian casualties, the use of phosphorus to burn people alive, including children. We know about the breaking of the ceasefire and how the breaking of the ceasefire started. And what's really amazing about this debate, and I actually see it in the room now, in the faces of a few people, is the fact that labeling is really common in this struggle. So in other words, when people debate you, they don't debate you, they just call you an anti-Semite, which would be news to, for example, to Hedy Epstein, the Holocaust survivor who led the Gaza Freedom March through the streets of Cairo. But that's just something I want to mention, because sometimes this debate gets really silly. Like the other side just wants to hurl insults, right? You're anti-Semite, you're anti-Semite, you're anti-Semite, or the Palestinians just want to kill us all. But the fact is we know where the phosphorus is being dropped. We know that there are hundreds and hundreds of days of curfews. Imagine living under curfew day after day after day, or not being able to visit your neighbors, or seeing your fields that have been in your family for hundreds, if not thousands of years, being destroyed or taken. Or seeing settlers walk around with machine guns in your own territory. I wonder how Israelis would feel about that, Palestinians or anybody else running around their territory with machine guns controlling the streets. So, the lack of mobility and the fact that life is a big jail, and we know that the news reporting is obviously incomplete too. So I start this by asking a couple of questions. How does taking more territory from someone protect Israelis or Palestinians? How does that work exactly? And also, if you want peace, how does violent oppression and land theft help that cause of peace? So I'm going to talk about three things tonight. I've got, what time? Do you have keeping time on this? You said I had 15 minutes, but the clock's not working here anymore. Is there a clock here? Okay. Sorry about that. Yeah, just me. Okay. So I'm going to talk about these things just really briefly, the role of Canadian state, because I think sometimes we wrap ourselves up in this Canadianness, especially, you know, sort of people I've noticed that I've traveled, my travels in the Union of Anglo-Saxon descent from across Canada, really have a tendency to think, you know, Canada's a great place, and we put a little label on our backpacks, and everybody will love us because we're not like U.S. citizens. And I don't think people are really aware of the image that Canada is developing in the world, and has already in many places, including First Nations here. But I would say, in fact, that Canada is a pariah nation that tries to maintain a good public image of Canadianness. And they're really sensitive to this, because in reality, and it's been said, you know, this is a colonial country, right? Land was taken from somebody else and hasn't been resolved. That's a fact. Nobody can dispute that. You were the land of security certificates, where people were thrown in jail without charge or evidence. A country of extreme secrecy. I think Canada, if I'm not mistaken, is the most secretive of the OECD countries to get information. You know, we're a country of hundreds and hundreds of missing women, which is an epidemic. We're definitely a climate criminal, and we're seen like this around the world as a real climate pariah. We profiteer off of war. And I find this interesting connection between this whole thing about apartheid, Canada, South Africa, and Israel. Because the fact is that the original apartheid, I think, was here in Canada. We just haven't called it that yet, although people are starting to. But isn't it interesting that the South African government came here in the 40s to study our reservation system and to go back and implement apartheid in South Africa? And isn't it interesting that Israel is one of the last supporters in the world, last public open supporters of South Africa in the world? So that's all of this stuff is of interest, I think raises some eyebrows, but also brings us back to the role of Canadians and our responsibility, because what we do here is so obviously important to what happens in other places around the world. And at least standing up says we will not be complicit in crimes against humanity. We will not be complicit in use of chemical weapons on human populations, blowing up schools. You know, I was talking to a guy, an astrophysicist in the Gaza Freedom March, and he had been working with a scientist in Gaza who was outside of Gaza when the attacks happened, when the massacre happened last year. And his son, his child, 10-year-old child, was shot in his house. So he claimed that actual people were being, communities, some families were being targeted. They weren't activist families necessarily. They were the educated, those that, you know, would be a huge asset to a future Palestinian state. Those families were actually literally being targeted in their homes, including children. So I'm going to talk then just a little bit about the Gaza Freedom March, and then I'll finish with the Union stuff. So the Gaza Freedom March, for those of you who don't know, were around 1,300 people coming from around the world, from many countries of all cultures and languages, who came to break the siege of Gaza. And why? Well, because we're saying, okay, you don't want arms to go through. If you don't want, you know, all this stuff, then let food and medicine go through. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with bringing material aid to a society? We're not bringing weapons. So it seems to me that this is a completely honest and open and just thing to do. No people should live under these circumstances. No people should live in a full-time open-air jail. And no people should be trapped, be bombed, and gassed. So as it unfolded, of course, the Mubarak, the president of Egypt, who seems to be very compliant with U.S. policy. And for those of you who don't know, Israel, I was even shocked by this, is Israel is somewhat of a serious police state. There's plainclothes guys in every corner, and they check the hotel ledgers every day, and blah, you know, all this stuff. But anyway, we got there, and they wouldn't give us buses. They prevented buses from taking anybody to Gaza. So and in many ways, this backfired on Mubarak. And oh, by the way, the second day we were there, Netanyahu arrived for meetings with Mubarak. But this was receiving quite a bit of press in the Middle East, and certainly in Egypt. Egyptian citizens showing support for our demonstrations, even a thumbs up or a smile or a fist in the air, would be immediately thrown into the back seat of an unmarked car by plainclothes guys and driven away. So you would see people walking down the street giving you a wink or kind of a thumbs up, but not being too open about it in the early days of the protests. But we continued the protests every day, and in fact, and in many places, in many parts. There were central protests, and then there were sort of more diversified protests. But this, I think, gave something to Cairo that they haven't seen for a while. So much so that one night, the journalist syndicate decided to hold a demonstration and used the Gaza Freedom Marchers to surround them as protection, and had a really loud, vibrant, militant demonstration in Egypt, just about their own freedoms. I'm really appreciative of us being there. So we saw this as a really important way of raising the public profile in the Middle East. We chose to attempt to walk to Gaza if they wouldn't let us give us buses. And so people assembled. Actually, it really worked out really well for people who are like me, who are so unorganized, to see this. But they said that you can't assemble any more than 6 people in Egypt, at least the time we were there, and unless it's like a festival or cultural event or something. But just more than 6 people sort of hanging out, talking politics or holding a demonstration or something is illegal. And so we knew we were being watched constantly. And there were infiltrators everywhere. There were police even sitting in the meetings, in plain clothes and so on. So what happened was people went down to the National Museum one morning and were in groups of 5 and 6 and not connected in any way. And we're told to, when you see the flags go up, jump in behind the flags and start marching to Gaza. And so here you see this assembly of there's nothing going on, and suddenly a flag goes up, and within 30 seconds there's over 1,000 people marching down the street. That was really, really impressive. And so what struck me is that people weren't going to surrender out of fear. Now, obviously, Westerners particularly have privilege wherever they go. We're tourists, whatever. For whatever reason, they don't want to seem to, not too much anyway, at least if we're white, to beat us or jail us or anything. So it put the Israeli state the Egyptian state in a kind of odd place. The riot cops were sent to every demonstration and would surround demonstrations 3 rows deep. But these were all young men who were, like early 20s, paid a pittance, fed one meal a day, and forced to stand for 8 hours in riot gear. And when their captains weren't looking, they would say to us, "We support you. We're with you. We don't want to be here. This is wrong, what's happening." And that was really powerful for the demonstrators too, and probably something people here don't very often experience from riot police. "Hey, we're with you." So the danger was these plainclothes guys. They were the guys to look out for. But during these series of actions and nonviolent assemblies out in the street and out in the open, a fairly hostile Egyptian, and there weren't many. Most people were supportive quietly. But one man approached me and said, "What the hell are you people doing? You have no business here. You're all a bunch of idiots, da 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 da." And I said, "Well, don't you think that people in Gaza deserve to live in freedom too, and to live, and have a peaceful life and have their land and be able to control their territory?" And he said, "I'm not saying that. I'm saying you are responsible for this mess." "I mean, what do you mean?" So he says, "The West, the North and the West. This wasn't created by Israel. It wasn't created by Palestine. It was created by you, the British, the French. That's... every time you interfere in the Middle East, this is what results." And that resonated with me and sort of reminded me of the work to do here for the responsibilities and the policies and practices that come out of this part of the world. So what was the history of the CUPW, my union? My union has 54,000 members. I'm really proud of being in a national union that has supported the BDS campaign and peace in the occupied territories. We've been really active, mostly in just producing material like posters for Israeli Apartheid Week. We've done that. We provide speakers. We've sent countless letters. We produce fact sheets. I didn't bring any with me tonight, but I can see there's enough facts out on the table that people should be filled up with that stuff. Anyway, we produce bulletins to our members. We've had plenary discussions at our educationals, and so just trying to raise, you know, raise the profile, have the debate, have the discussions, and move the campaign forward. And sort of just go through a little bit of our history. In 2002, to my knowledge anyway, we were the first union in North America to pass a resolution against Israel. And this resolution called for return to the Resolution 242 and return to the boundaries of 1967. And it passed virtually unanimously. It was an emergency resolution. The Second Intifada was going on, and a resolution was passed around. The process in our union is you have to sign, you have to get 10% of the delegates to sign a resolution for it to be considered an emergency resolution. We actually had 80%. And we stopped. We just figured, well, we could just keep going and get them all, but what's the point? Let's just get it on the floor and have the debate. And that's what happened. And so that was passed in 2002, and about a month later, I think CUPE passed a resolution, and then the Canadian Labour Congress, a resolution went through there. And so then we come to 2008 and this process of the BDS resolution. This came from North Bay, Ontario, actually, from a small town where resolution was passed at the local level, debated, supported, passed, and was spread to other locals and other around the country, and it was passed by several locals and came to our national convention in 2008, where we have approximately, I think, just over 500 delegates, 500 plus delegates representing locals. They're elected from their locals across the country, from coast to coast to coast. Had the debate. It was pretty a long debate. There wasn't much opposition, but there was fierce opposition. Mostly that this was anti-Semitic. No one took on the charges that were made about the occupation. It just became, well, we're being anti-Semitic if we do this. You know, this is all one-sided. Subsequently, we've sent people to Palestine in the occupied territories. In fact, Christian Martel from Quebec City was there for the second time. He's been refused entry to Gaza twice, so who knows? Maybe he'll go back a third time. I don't know. But we've had our director from the central region, Mark Evard, has been to the West Bank recently. We sent two people to the Gaza Freedom March, plus I went on my own. So there's a fair amount of activity going on, but the question remains is where do we take it? Now, for trade union, this is really important to us in terms of the workers' connection, because why the hell can't Palestinians have the same workers' rights that Israelis have? I mean, that's fundamental to any trade union, right? Equality. So to have a trade union federation extracting money off the pay of Palestinian workers, it's just corrupt and perverse. That is not trade unionists. That's not trade unionism. And this is the relationship that we see internationally, where Hester Drew makes great effort to go around and participate in labor conventions around the world and put that nice face on Israel, that we're so great and oppressed and everybody's out to get us and we're victims and we're not doing anything wrong. And how many people remember that in actual fact the ceasefire was broken by the Israelis? Right? People know that, right? So they're going to protect yourself, but you break the ceasefire. Interesting. So back to Hester Drew, I think, and the trade unions, one thing that's really important for us is to be present at labor federations, federations of labor conventions. Now, some of you may be trade unionists, most of you probably aren't, but you can still try to get tables there or work through unions like ours who can get tables to raise a profile, pass the information, have the debates, have those discussions. I think that's really important. How much time? Another minute? Okay. So at the last Ontario Federation of Labour Convention, the Canadian Labour Congress Convention, we had guests from Hester Drew. And we had a guest there from Palestine. And the man from the Palestine General Federation of Trade Unions wasn't even recognized. And Hester Drew was up on the stage. Now, this is perverse. So this we can take on as trade unionists here, and we must take that on because it's unjust. You can't extort money from workers and call yourself a trade union. You can't do it here, and you can't do it there. That's not trade unionism. So that's a really important piece for us. So, and of course, whatever we do at the local level is really important. So if you can't get resolutions through the big unions, whatever, work it at the local level. That's how it worked with us. Just get it through there and start building it from there. Because what's happening is wrong. We all know it. And so I'll just leave you with these questions. What's wrong with a peaceful solution? Aren't Palestinians human beings? Why can't they live as such? And is it right that Palestinians are constantly evicted and attacked on their own territories? So I'll just leave it with that, and I'm looking very much forward to hearing the other speakers. And again, from the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, we're really encouraged by this campaign and by you being here tonight and by all the people active in this. And thank you to the organizers for having us. So thank you.